guys, welcome to the Better Building Systems Podcast. I'm your host, Clayton Ferry, and here with me are special guests Joe Panisi and Michael Tosevsky with RP Fetter, as well as Nick Taliska and Mark Sankey. In today's podcast, we'll be discussing cleanroom design and standard and molecular type cleanrooms. So before we dive into the conversation, as always when we bring on guests, let's let Joe and Michael introduce themselves as well as RP Fetter. So with that being said, I'll let Joe and Mike jump in.
Okay, Mike, you want to go first?
Yeah. Thanks for having us on. My name's Mike Tosevsky. I'm a sales engineer at RP Fetter. And as a sales engineer, my role revolves around helping business owners, engineers, and contractors create comfortable, efficient, and controlled indoor environments. I've been in the HVAC industry specifically for 8 years. Before that, I spent a few years in industrial filtration, and my goal as a sales engineer is to educate other engineers and organizations about specific products and provide solutions to their mechanical and clean room problems.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, man. And I guess Joe will let you bring her home.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Clayton. And thank you for letting us come on your program today. My name is Joe Panisi. I've been in the HVAC business for 40 years. I have a 2-year associate's degree in air conditioning from Alfred State and a 4-year bachelor's degree from RIT in energy engineering. I've been with RP Fetter Industrial for the past 34 years and presently the vice president of sales. RP Fetter is a manufacturer's rep and OEM manufacturer of filtration heating equipment servicing Western New York since 1959. My focus has primarily been air filtration, which includes a very broad spectrum dealing in HVAC, dust collection, odor control, molecular contamination, exhaust systems, and today's topic, clean rooms. I deal in all aspects of clean room design, but my strength is in design-build projects. Industries I deal with include optics, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, semiconductors, microelectronics, research labs, and plastic injection facilities. Working with owners, architects, engineers, and contractors, I focus on one goal, educating my customers to provide the best solution for his or her application, so at the end of the project, we both walk away satisfied that we achieved the best possible results.
Awesome. Thank you. So we have the right people on, obviously, for a clean room podcast discussion. And I think it's going to be, for our listeners, there's a lot to cover for this topic. And I can see this going, a lot of discussion, and then we can have some follow-up episodes as well for it. So I'm really looking forward to it. I think a good starting point is just kind of set the stage for clean rooms. And if our listeners aren't familiar with them, Joe, you kind of covered, I think, the types of owners you work with for clean rooms, it seems like about all of them, right? Every different type of manufacturing process related to a clean room or different type of clean room you kind of deal with, right? For the most part.
That's correct. Clean rooms fall into a lot of different categories, but what a clean room basically is a controlled environment where we're trying to control the airborne particles less than or greater than 0.5 micron. So people kick around class 100, class 1000, class 10,000. What does that mean? Well, what that means in simple terms is that if I walk into a clean room, I can grab 1 cubic foot of air. And if I measure that cubic foot of air through a particle counter for a class 100, I should have no more than 100 0.5 micron sized particles in that cubic foot of air. So that in simple terms is what a clean room is defined as. A lot of people are going to say, well, what's a micron mean? Well,
right.
A micron is a measurement of a particle size. So if you take a look at what the human eye can see, we can see down to around 30 or 40 microns. If you take table salt, that's around 40, 50 microns in size. So what we're dealing with is particles we can't even see.
Joe, for a reference, what's the general particle count of ambient air, outdoor air?
Oh, I mean, you could look up the EPA monitors that, and you can get those EPA standards. But depending on where you are, if you're out in the country or even in the city, you could be anywhere from 100, 200,000 particles, 0.5.
Yep.
Yeah, so the outside air is very contaminated. Not so much here in Rochester, but if you get into the big cities, it is very contaminated with pollutants and car exhaust and all kinds of different things.
What about to add on to that question? That was a good question, Mark. What about just like, your house? And that probably varies a lot as well, but.
Well, in your house, you've got different contaminants. You've got your people, you got your pets, you got doors opening and closing. So, in your house, it's a little bit more controlled, but you still have large counts that could be into the, 50 to 100,000 particle size of 0.5 and larger. That's why it's always a good practice. People, ask me about this, and I say, well, the biggest benefit is to turn your fan on and run it continuously so your filter is always filtering the air.
Oh yeah, that's a great point.
And I always tell people, if you have a fiberglass filter in your furnace, replace it immediately because it's doing nothing for you. You have to have a minimum of a pleated filter, okay? And then from there you go up.
Right. What, are you trying to put Lowe's out of business? What are you doing there, Joe?
So,
Point.
yeah, so for the clean rooms, that's I think a good comparison. For if you're not familiar with them to understand, like a class 100 clean room is, I get you still can get cleaner, right? You can get like class 10 and
Oh
what have you.
class
But I
one,
mean,
class
class
10.
100 is a very, very clean space, and you're wearing the whole bunny suit, get up, face mask, everything's covered for the most part, right? Because your skin sheds particles, so you want.
Exactly. A good indication if you're in a class 100 room is you should be able to look in the ceiling and see 100% coverage of HEPA filters. That means that you are in a class 100 area. And we keep on using class 100, class 10,000. That is actually the old federal 209D standard. We no longer use that, and now it's all based on ISO and the ISO standard 14644-1. Has replaced that old federal standard and basically same parameters, but it's a little bit tighter.
So, Joe, for the folks that aren't in the business, tell us what a HEPA filter is, what that means, and what it does.
Okay, a HEPA filter. Okay, a HEPA filter is obviously everyone knows what an air filter is. Okay, and every air filter has a MERV rating, which tells you what particles it could pull out of the air. Okay, so if you look at a standard pleated filter, that has a MERV rating of 8. So if you take a 10 micron size particle, which is a boulder inside of a clean room, it's going to take about 75 to 90% of that out. Well, when you get into HEPA filtration, you're now dealing with a filter that's going to filter down to 0.3 micron size. And is factory tested to be 99.97. So that means that 0.03% of 0.3 micron is getting through that filter. So now that filter could also go up to 99.99 and also 99.59s, which is a ULPA filter. So all those are the different standards and the different ways. When you ensure that your clean room is clean, you obviously got to make sure your filter is tested. And those are typically tested at the manufacturer's facility, and it's labeled with an ISO standard to test it to that 0.3 micron size. And it's delivered in that fashion.
Great. Perfect.
Yeah,
Thank
I mean,
you.
that's just an impressive amount of filtration to consider. I think it in the industry we work in, that's the norm and you get used to it. But when you really think about it, that's a lot of filtration. And then kind of to add to that discussion of filtration, I got two things. So when you're in a clean room, right, and you have your bunny suits on and you're work there's workers in a clean room working on a process and there's equipment. Like once you're clean per se, right? Equipment gets cleaned off and brought in there, and people are wearing suits and brought in there. Where do the particles come from then? I mean, people are just constantly shedding particles, right? And equipment.
I was going to ask about the bunny suit thing because some people may not even know what that is.
Well, let's first talk about our sources of contamination, because that will lead into the bunny suit. So there are really three potential sources for contamination. The first one is outside air. Okay, so you're always bringing in outside air into the clean room. So that's got to go through its cleaning process, 30%, 95% through a HEPA and then into the space. That's got to be properly filtered. So that's one source of potential contamination. The other is the process itself. Process may be developing some type of particulate that could potentially contaminate the room. And that obviously could be remedied through an exhaust system or through a recirculation system that would capture that. But the by far the biggest source of contamination are people when they walk into the room, because even when you're sitting at rest or in motion, you're generating thousands and thousands of particulate off of your body via skin and hair. So all of this is contamination inside of the room. What you do is, and we'll get back to the bunny suit, is you before you walk into a clean room, you have what's called an anteroom. Now the anteroom is a space that, one, segregates the clean room from the outside so you can maintain positive pressure, but two, it gives the people a space to change out of their street clothes and get into a bunny suit. Okay, what's a bunny suit? Well, in a clean room, since you are shedding all these particles off your body, you have to gown up. So what that means is that, like for a class 100,000 or a class 10,000, you would simply put a hair net to control your hair. If you have a beard, you put a beard net on, you put a smock on, and you would put booties. Okay. If you could think of when you're walking around, you're generating, you're picking up off your shoes a lot of contamination. So we want to capture all that and make sure that doesn't get into the room. So you put on booties. So that is the bare bones minimum that you would have in a clean room. Now, when you get into a class 1000, class 100, you get into a full bunny suit. That means you are completely covered from head to toe in a full body suit. Your neck, face, everything is covered, and all you have is a set of goggles that you're looking out of that to see. But you're wearing gloves. You're completely gowned up, so there is no exposed body parts, surface, clothing that's exposed to the clean room, and that's all contained inside of this bunny suit.
And the material of construction of the bunny suit is of something that doesn't shed particles and contains particles inside it.
Yeah, right. It's a non-shedding material that
kind of stuff.
And a lot of them are disposable, but there are laundry services that actually laundry those suits in a clean room, and they are folded and repackaged and sent back. But yeah, that's they're all non-shedding particles. Correct.
Yep. Amazing.
It is. It really is. So we covered, you know, what makes particles, the different types of classes of clean rooms, and how clean those classes really are, right? And then different types of filters.
Can I ask, how many classes are there of clean rooms? I assume, you know, these are all the ISO classifications, right?
Right. The ISO goes from ISO 1 all the way up to ISO 9. So, for example, ISO 7 was your old class 10,000 standard.
Right. What's one?
One is very, 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 very clean.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean,
so you're getting, you know, I mean, it's
because a five is class 100, right?
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, that's just inconceivably clean to go cleaner than that.
One is the most stringent, nine the least stringent. And these old terms, like when I hear people say class 100. Those are older terms, but that 100 also refers to the particle size or something, right?
Right. You cannot, the old term was is that you could not get less. You have to have less than 100.5 particles in the every cubic foot of air.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And how they do that is there's machines, particle counters, okay, that measure this. But they do is they bring in 1 cubic foot of air across a lens, and they scan it with a laser, and they measure all these particles to determine what that is. So in a clean room, what you would do is you would have several locations that you would test to verify that your room is in compliance. And some people do it at the beginning of a startup on a clean room, and then have to recertify every 6 months to a year to ensure their customers are, their product is being, you know, manufactured in a clean environment, and they have to give that to their customer to certify production. Or if you're in a pharmaceutical, the FDA or whoever the governing body is.
Okay, so no immediate in situ type of testing for particle sizes? You have to take a sample, get to a lab?
No, the laser particle counter is a machine you put right in the space, and you roll it around, and it measures it right there in the spot.
Oh, fascinating. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, and I think they kind of do a, you could do up, you know, the whole cubic foot, right? But you could also do like samples and it'd extrapolate and what have you. So it speeds up the process. You can get a pretty quick understanding of where you are at that instant for particle count.
But not a constant measurement thing like maybe CO2 would be.
That's a good question.
You can get systems that will do multiple locations. And what you would do is you would have a string of tubing.
Sample tubing,
yes. That would go back to kind of a, I want to call it like a round gauntlet that cycles through, and you would sample every 30 seconds or every minute. Yes, you can do that. In critical spaces, they do that. But you're talking about a class 1 or class 10 environment. Yeah. But yeah, that is possible. That is possible.
Interesting.
For airflow, you know, we talk about, and you say you look up, and if it's a class 100, you're going to see a full HEPA density, right? And class 10,000 will be whatever, 50% or 30% HEPA. So the typical airflow for a clean room is your HEPA filter pulls air from above it in a interstitial or plenum space.
You're talking about a FFU.
So yes, yes.
Let's talk about FFUs for a minute.
Yeah, I guess typically in clean rooms, there's two types of HEPA filtration designs. One being HEPA filters that are ducted to the space and they're installed in the air handling unit or the ceiling. And the other is the use of a HEPA fan filter unit. The HEPA fan filter unit just provides filtration and recirculation of the air to the clean room. And their design's pretty simple. It's not much more than a HEPA filter attached to a centrifugal blower in a housing, and then that housing fits inside a standard 2x4 or 4x4 ceiling grid.
So that pulls air from above the space, right? Above the ceiling.
And yep, blows in a it, plenum.
Yeah, in a plenum. Okay. And then blows it down into the clean room, right? If it's the room or one area of it. You know, some of them are, I don't know, ballroom wide open, and some have rooms dividing them. So that airflow pattern, it changes depending on the class of clean room, right? As you get cleaner, you may want more, would you say, laminar flow as opposed to, I don't know what you would call, like turbulent or whatever. I mean,
you're either laminar or unidirectional. We'll start with laminar because that's easy to understand.
Right.
You know, laminar flow is usually, you know, an ISO 5 class 100 type of environment. Laminar flow just means is your airflow is in a pattern that's parallel with the walls. It's called parallelism. Okay, so in a true laminar flow clean room, you would have a raised floor so that your, if you have 100% coverage, that air flows down in a parallel fashion down to the floor and then is returned back up into the plenum. Okay, that gets very, very expensive. Raised floors are very, very expensive.
Right.
So most of them are unidirectional. So that means is that the class 100 room would have a perimeter return around the complete perimeter. Okay, so your air would come down, and for the most part, you're parallel until you get to the last couple feet of the room, and then you go non-laminar and you return into the return air grills.
Right.
So it's really, you're really either unidirectional or you're laminar.
Okay. And I assume, like you said, that unidirectional would probably be more common due to cost constraints and construction constraints and facility constraints with particle counts. You know, you can
Yeah,
do it.
you usually don't, think about it. Your raised floor is 12 inches off,
Right.
the room's 10 feet. You
Yeah.
know, if you have a plenum above, that's another 3 feet. I mean, you start to grow, so you want to try to keep as low as possible. You might have certain height restrictions. I want to say the majority of the rooms are unidirectional, where they just have a lot of perimeter returns.
You're trying to keep the or reduce the turbulence inside the space, right? When you're laying that all out in the design.
What if you could envision, say that for every airflow that comes down, you had a string, okay? You took those strings and you saw how it comes down, and it's parallel with the wall till you're a couple feet off the ground, and now you're going to start to turn and go inside of your returns. Well, that area or that little tripod is a point of turbulence or potential turbulence that, if there was dust or contaminants in the room, could possibly kick up. Okay, so you try to minimize that, and you minimize that by slowing the air down and trying to get as much return around the room as possible.
Makes sense to me. You don't want particles, you know, any particles shedded or kicked up from people. You want to get go down, out, and through, and recirculate through the HEPAs to get cleaned, right?
Exactly,
Yeah.
exactly.
Yep. All makes sense. Do we want to shift gears a little bit from filtration then and talk about some of the other aspects of the critical aspects, especially of clean rooms? Or is there any more questions on filtration that we want to add for our listeners or discussion points?
So, do any of you guys want to know where HEPA comes from?
Where does
Yeah,
HEPA come
I
from?
think that it's interesting.
Absolutely.
The
Yeah.
store, right? I mean, that's what
The
comes off the tip of my
HEPA
tongue.
store? It's just magically made from the
Amazon, come on.
HEPA fairy. Okay, a HEPA filters have been around only since 1940s. They were developed by the U.S. Army through the Manhattan Project. Scientists
Wow.
realized that the radioactive particles used to make the atomic bomb were harmful to humans, so they needed to develop a filter that would filter out these radioactive particles. They found that 0.3 micron size was the perfect size to remove those radioactive particles. Today, HEPAs look much different than they did back in the 1940s, but the theory is still the same. We're still removing 0.3 micron size particles, whether it's 99.97 or 99.999995, it's still the same theory that it was back in the 1940s.
I knew it was going to be a good story.
Yeah. Complete sidebar, but I found it interesting. I was doing a little research, you know, when we had all that smoke from the wildfires and the to me this is a good visualization, right? And you can tell me if I'm wrong. I just got information from the internet, but you know, the smoke haze, a HEPA filter does a pretty good job of cleaning the air even from smoke, right? Like smoke particulates are around that size, 0.3
Well, the, yeah,
or
not to go off into tangents here, but if you take a look at smoke, yeah, smoke is generally around that 0.3
Yeah.
size, okay? But smoke, you smell and you
Yes.
see, okay? If you can smell something, it is a particulate, okay? I drive my wife crazy because she wants all these perfumes and stuff in the house. I says, well, if you smell it, it's a particulate and you're
Huh.
breathing it in.
Yeah.
So the smoke that you see, yes, can be taken out with a HEPA filter because it is in that 0.3 size and can do a very effective job of it. The problem is people can't put HEPA filters on their homes and in
Right.
businesses because of the pressure drop of a HEPA filter.
Yep.
But you are correct. It is a good way of removing smoke from an airstream.
That was just my like aha moment. Like that's a good comparison for to understand what size particulate we're talking about. You know, it's
Joe, could you repeat that? You said if you can smell it, and then does that mean it's a certain size particulate?
Yep. You just can't see it, but if you can smell it, it's a particle size that
That's a particle size. Okay.
yeah.
Interesting.
Kind of disturbing now that I think about it, but.
Well, you know, when you're out in the countryside and you're driving along and
you see
a farmer spreading cow manure and you smell it, that's a particulate that you're breathing in. You know, granted the dosage is there, but the concentration is very, 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 very minor. So a lot of your nostrils and stuff, your nose will filter that out. But yeah, it is a particulate.
Yeah.
How come I'm okay with that, but not smelling somebody else's gas in a closed environment? I don't know. I just like nature, I guess.
Nature. Well, yeah.
You know, that's why I get very upset when I see young people smoking or vaping, because, geez, you're just taking those particulates and throwing it in your lungs. It's very, very detrimental.
Yeah.
Directly. Yes. No dilution.
Yeah.
Don't you mean to tell me the little filters on the end of those don't do anything? Come on.
Are doing nothing.
Well, so I'm going to ask another question then. So based on that, okay, and what was the size of the COVID virus approximately? I think it was like 0.03 microns. It was pretty small.
Yeah, when COVID came out, did a lot of research into this, and yeah, the COVID micron, the actual virus itself was submicron. It was down below 0.1.
So, but the mask mandate was basically based on its attachment to water vapor that we exhaled or inhaled.
Correct. The COVID virus will only live, I believe, 24 hours. It has to be on a host, a water vapor, to survive. And the theory is that when you exhale, if you have the virus on your exhale, okay, that you know when if you're on a cold day and you breathe and you
right. say that condenses.
Okay, yeah. You have that all the time.
Right.
Okay. So when you have those coming out, the mask was to try to help contain that. I don't know how good of a job it did, because the N95 masks are only 95%. I can't remember what micron size, but people have asked me, does a HEPA filter catch the virus? The answer is the raw virus. No.
No.
If the virus is attached to a water molecule, which it should be to survive, then the answer is yes.
Right.
That could be its own podcast series.
Right? I mean, I know. I just wanted to throw it out there.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you did. That might have to be the one of the other ones in our filtration series then, huh? Worthwhile. So I think we did a good job covering filtration then to that point. And, you know, being the clean room design podcast, I think we should talk a little bit about the other critical aspects of a clean room, which is, well, depending on the process and the facility, temperature, humidity, and pressure, right?
Yeah, those are the three main ones. You know, in some aspects, you know, there's molecular control, there's light control, but for the most part, those three are the ones that are basic in all clean rooms: temperature, humidity, and pressurization. Okay, so the first thing you have to look at is how quickly you're moving that air in the space. So, I mean, if you're in a class 100, chances are you're moving the complete volume of air of the space every 20 to 25 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have that kind of air exchange, what I found is it's pretty easy to maintain a good temperature humidity control, because you're moving that much air, you're getting a great mixing of the air in the space. So that's pretty easy to do. Pressurization, that is just bringing in enough air outside of the clean room to pressurize the space between 0.02 and 0.06 inches of water. And what you want to do is you want to make sure that your air flows, or your pressurization flows, from the clean room to your anteroom, and then the anteroom to the outside.
Right. So you don't want any infiltration. You want all exfiltration.
Right. Very few. There are a few rare instances where you have to have a negative clean room,
mm-hmm.
And that would be in an area where there's some contamination inside, like a TB room or something like that, where you don't want those contaminants to escape. That's a little different story. But right. I want to say for the most part, you want it to be a positively pressurized clean room.
Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, when you pointed out for where do contaminants come from, particles for labs, and you mentioned outside air, it's typically a pretty fair amount of outside air gets brought into these clean rooms to keep them positively pressurized. So you're always bringing in outside air and then thus always bringing in particles. So
exactly. You figure if you're, you know, usually it's about from a CFM, a square foot, to 10% of your HVAC air. So you're bringing in quite a bit. Okay. And you would typically have a separate unit just to condition your pressurization air.
Right.
And then it would go to your HVAC unit that would give you your temperature and humidity control of the space itself.
All right.
So I just a comment on the amount of outside air. So a couple of things drive that. Number one, the pressurization requirement. But number two, the prudent and judicious use of exhaust from the clean room. You know, what's appropriate for the process versus a cut and paste or a, we'll just use this amount because exhaust air, it's cheap to run a fan, but the air that you have to bring in, condition and filter to make up for that exhaust air is very expensive. And then the third is the actual quality of construction and attention to the detail of sealing of the outside of the clean room, the general construction practices.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're trying to fill up a balloon. If you poke a bunch of holes in it, you're going to have a hard time keeping air in
it,
right? Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. So your construction is critical in how you seal up that space to ensure that you have a tight air box, so to speak. And exhaust is a good point, Mark. I remember doing one room where we got to the very end of the project, and then I see an exhaust fan being installed. I'm going, what's that doing there?
We didn't size that for that.
So we didn't figure for that. So we had to scramble to try to compensate for it. But this is knowing your customer and knowing what the processes are inside so you can ensure that you have all the bases covered so you can react to those type of road bumps.
I got a question off of more pressurization. Now we started talking about temperature and for, you know how, Joe, you mentioned you want air to go from, say, your clean room to your ante room out, right, when you open the door?
Correct.
What mechanism do you do for that to create the pressure difference if, I don't know, like, say, the ante room, they're all coupled together by a common plenum?
Well, first off, you would have to have a wall between, okay, if you envision your plenum, you would have a wall between your ante room and your clean room. Okay, so that would be its own little environment. And you, in a clean room, dampers are your friend. Right. Everything has to be dampered, return air, supply. Everything has dampers because you want to be able, you don't know how well that construction is going to be. So you want to be able to have the flexibility to react to changing that return and trying to, you know, get to that, you know, 0.05 mark pretty easily. So, you would have to segregate the rooms that you're pressurizing. They have to be fully segregated from each other.
Mm-hmm. Ask a question about ventilation. So I know there's probably not any typical occupancy density numbers for clean rooms because they're so varied. But you know, how much of the outside air load is for the ventilation of the people in the space?
Or is that actually, a very small amount. You'll find that you bring in a lot more air than the ASHRAE standard for ventilation air requires. I've never seen where you're less than the ventilation required for ASHRAE in pressurization air.
Oh, I would imagine with the air changes you're talking about and obviously the pressurization. So are they noisy environments? Like is the air, you know, velocity, or are they
well in a clean room? Okay, you also we talked about all the different parameters, but another parameter is what we call ceiling coverage and air velocity coming out of your HEPA filter. So, like for example, We said class 100 is 100% ceiling coverage. A typical terminal HEPA diffuser has air coming in at 90 feet per minute. Okay, so 90 feet per minute is, if you put your hand up there and you're 6 inches away, you will not feel the air. Okay, it's very coming out very, very gently. So to answer your question, there is, as far as noise, it is pretty quiet for moving that much air.
It's quiet, but there is some white noise.
There's a white noise that you hear because you got air. But you have to remember that you also have the noise of your returns too.
Right.
Okay. So you try to oversize the returns as big as possible to reduce that noise. But still, if you take a, say, just a simple 600 square foot clean room, and that was a class 100, that's about 20,000 CFM. So imagine moving 20,000 CFM in a 600 square foot area. So like you said, Mark, you will get that white noise in the background. I wouldn't say it's not obnoxious or nothing that could cause you any bodily harm, but it's there and you can notice it.
But Nick, think about what we're doing here. The whole 20,000 CFM is distributed amongst a multitude of 2-foot by 4-foot ceiling FFUs with small fans in them. So it's basically a fan wall. You look at it as a fan wall. The fans are all running at low volume, low horsepower, and the velocity discharge from the ceiling is very low. So it's quieter than, you think, oh, I'm moving 20,000 CFM. I have a 10 horsepower fan or whatever. It's not like that at all. It's relatively quiet.
Yeah, like you said, a ventilation wall.
Yep.
I found is you the second you enter the clean room, you kind of notice it. And then if you're in there for an hour, 20 minutes, half an hour, I don't know, you start to just block it out. You don't even hear it anymore. So
exactly.
At least for the ones I've been in, it's not obnoxious at all. You do notice it the second you get in, and then it kind of, your mind blocks it out pretty easily. So do we want to talk about some of the HVAC styles or clean room layouts that you typically see? Like, do you see more of a ballroom style clean room? Like, if that's just a big one open box, or are they more broken out into, here's our 100 by 50 clean room, and then there's rooms inside of those clean rooms typically? I don't know if there's a balance that you see more of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say for the most part, clean rooms are more of a rectangular shape than a square shape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the reason for that is that if you envision our airflow coming down, I can stay more parallel in a rectangular room than I can in a square room and develop less turbulence. So I try to make the rooms long and narrow as opposed to a square box. The other thing we also try to do is sometimes we have clean rooms inside of clean rooms. We'll build a class 100,000, but we have a certain process that requires a class 100. We'll make a little mini environment, and we'll make a little clean room inside of our clean room to achieve that process goal.
Is that like it's got its own ceiling and walls kind of mini clean room, or it's just a segmented area with more filtration?
It could be both. It could be both. It could be making a an anodized aluminum structure tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the places where it's injection molding, we have parts coming off the machine that go right into a clean tunnel. And then that is brought into the clean room for additional process work. So it could be done in many different ways, but obviously the cost of clean rooms is very, very expensive.
Right.
I mean, a clean room could range anywhere from $200 to $1,200 a square foot, depending on what you're doing. So if I can make a class 100,000 room at $200 a square, and then just take a small portion and make it class 100, I could save the customer a lot of money, as opposed to saying, well, you need class 100 in the whole room. Well, you might not necessarily need that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then,
that's correct. And it's also then, so if you're thinking on a bigger scale, you have your ante room into the class 10,000 clean room, and then the 10,000 clean room, you're building a class 1,000 or 100 clean room inside that. And your class 10,000 clean room actually becomes the ante room for the class 100. You don't have any chance of infiltrating raw, unconditioned air into the class 100 space.
Exactly.
And then you mentioned, you know, expense for these clean rooms, and there's obviously all the supporting equipment, the fan filter units, HEPAs, air handling units, you know. And what about the general construction? I think this is a good segue into just talking about the general construction. You know, this isn't a, and I know people that know clean rooms are going to just joke or laugh when I say this, thinking it's a joke, but you know, this isn't a 2x4 construction drywall room, right, with a typical ceiling grid. These are purpose built facilities with purpose, you know, built equipment. And I don't know, something worth covering maybe for our listeners that aren't.
And materials.
Because materials.
You not only have first construction, but then there's maintenance, which is basically cleaning and rigorous cleaning. So, speak to that.
First let's talk about construction. Okay. The first thing we need to know is that everything is non-shedding.
Right.
And a smooth surface. Okay. So if you vision inside of a clean room, you don't want to have any ledges or surfaces for any dust to collect. Everything's got to be a smooth, straight construction.
You want vertical lines, not horizontal.
Vertical lines, right. You want constructions of the wall. You know, for lower classification, class 100,000, done rooms with just drywall with epoxy paint. Not my first choice, but because of cost, a lot of customers go that route. What I like to see are honeycomb panels that have a sheet of aluminum on both sides, smooth surface, and are painted with a, you know, with an ESD style paint, and that are battened to a metal stud in the wall. And as far as the ceiling, there'd be, again, aluminum, anodized aluminum track that's gasketed with a non-outgassing gasket.
Mm-hmm.
Tiles would be Mylar tiles, or sometimes I'll use quarter-inch honeycomb panels as my tile.
Hmm.
Literally every piece that's exposed in there has got to be
evaluated
to those standards.
Hmm. Correct.
Yeah, you need smooth surfaces so they're easy to clean and everything's sealed, right?
Yeah, and as Joe mentioned, even the materials of construction, adhesives, sealants, everything is evaluated for off-gassing, right? Yes. Everything. Yep.
Everything that goes into that room, because all of it is an integral portion. So sometimes people get hung up that, you know, it's the HVAC guys that have to make it a class 100. Well, that's not true. It's the architect and the engineer working together, because our walls, our ceiling, our floor, all that system is contributing to the cleanliness of that space. So all of that has to be considered as part of the overall package of making that room a class 100.
That's a great point, Joe. And really central to this whole podcast is that it starts right at the design. The design engineering team and their integration with an understanding with the suppliers, what can be built, how it can be built. That's a great point.
Okay, so how big can these clean rooms get? Like, I've seen a few on the smaller side, I would imagine. But then I think of places like Intel, right? How large a facility can be a clean room within reason?
They
could be huge, Nick. Some of the big ones, the Intels and people like that, these rooms are gigantic. They're huge.
And the same is true for the pharmaceuticals. When you see a pharmaceutical clean room, it's, you know, manufacturing on a large scale, high speed, and the places are big.
Exactly.
That's remarkable to me to just get your mind around that scale of it. Like I said, it's such a niche, controlled environment that I don't think a lot of people think about or are aware of. I mean, maybe some of you don't even know what a clean room is, but, you know, just doing some of my own research and seeing, you know, how important and vital they are to so many different industries, and it's only seems to be increasing.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I thought this episode was very worthwhile to have. And you know, even for me, now that they're on my radar more, there's a lot of facilities that you could drive by through your town, and it's just a normal looking, I don't know, commercial building on the outside, and they might have a lot of clean rooms inside or what have you, you know. It's not glaringly obvious for a lot of places that, oh, there's a clean room in there, and a lot of manufacturing processes depend on them for different types of industries, like we said. So I find it very interesting.
Well, and to be honest with you, I never heard of molecular clean rooms either.
And we didn't cover that even yet. Holy cow.
Got that far yet. But you're absolutely right, Clayton. You'd be surprised at who has clean rooms out there. And all those clean rooms are designed and built to have a function. And that function is to produce a product in there that has a detriment to particles or right. outgassing. You know, in the semiconductor, it's, you know, the wafers and, you know, the lines of resolution are getting smaller and smaller. So obviously, if you get a particle on that, the wafer is gone. So you're trying to protect that. So you're right. There's a lot of people out there that have clean rooms, functioning clean rooms, that are required by either their customer or the product itself to be manufactured inside of a controlled environment.
Yep. I was just very impressed, you know, as I got into this industry, the amount of facilities that use clean rooms for all kinds of different products that they make, right, in different industries. So it was a big takeaway for me, for sure. Good industry to be in.
The one thing, Clayton, we didn't talk about, and I don't want to steal your thunder, if we didn't really talk about systems themselves and the different kinds of systems that support a clean room.
I think we should. Absolutely. If you think that this is a good segue into it. Yeah.
Yeah. There's basically two types. Okay. One is direct ducted. Okay. Where you're ducting all that air to individual terminal HEPAs. The advantage with this is that you only have one fan. The disadvantage is you've only got one fan.
Right.
But if you can envision a class 100 room, that ductwork becomes huge. And now you've got all this ductwork going all over the place, and you're trying to keep tabs on that. Well, what we like to use is what I've kind of coined as a primary secondary kind of a system, where we have a system where we have a ceiling height of 10 feet. Mm-hmm. And then at 3 feet above that, we have another roof on top of that that encloses that plenum. And then inside that plenum would be fan-powered HEPAs. Each of those fan-powered HEPAs would produce 600 CFM that's being delivered to the space at 90 feet per minute. That air is then drawn down to the clean room, up through the return walls, and back to that plenum above. Now, the advantage to this is that, for one, you don't have large ductwork all over the place. Now you have an HVAC system that's sized just for your space load and delivers conditioned space air into that upper plenum, and then
right.
fan-powered HEPAs deliver that air down into the space. Because you have to remember is that your clean room is somewhere around, you know, could be up to as much as 500 air changes, but your HVAC air is only somewhere around maybe 10 air changes. The two never meet.
Right.
So this allows you to make your HVAC system a little bit smaller, much smaller, and then let the fan-powered HEPAs do the bulk of the air change work inside of the clean room.
Yeah, so they're decoupled kind of
yes.
through the plenum, right? That's where it all kind of connects, I guess, if you would say. But
If you're using air handlers to recirculate that air and filter it, they'd be huge. They take up space, a lot of weight.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Yep. And then like Joe mentioned, if something goes down, that's it.
Right, pressurization easily, don't got the redundancy.
Yep, yep. So if you drew a box of your clean room and you added another lid to that box, your HEPAs are circulating really fast between the inside space and the plenum, and then your air handling units are just circulating, I guess, much slower comparatively just with the plenum space.
Correct. And the secret to making that work is that your HVAC air has got to be distributed evenly across that negative plenum. If right. you don't, you will develop hot spots and cold spots inside the clean room, because it's pretty common that the air, when the air is released inside of that plenum, it disperses, but in a very small pattern. Okay.
Right.
So if you don't get that evenly dispersed, you're going to have some issues. So, because I have seen it before where a contractor will just drop it in one or two spots and just open it up into the plenum. Well, then we have issues. It has to be delivered uniformly across the whole negative plenum.
That's just done through ductwork?
Yes. Yep.
What about in the space, you know, in the clean room where you have higher concentrations of heat load, we'll say, right? So you got a piece of equipment that makes a lot of heat. How do you kind of prevent or induce that mixing so you're not short cycling that equipment's heat in that space? Just make sure you have adequate airflow so there's good mixing.
Right. What I would do is I would increase the airflow and bring ductwork over to that space or that area.
Right.
Satisfy the need of that. Again, the fan-powered HEPAs will do their job, but unless it has air, conditioned air coming to it, it mm-hmm. will not be able to condition that space properly. So.
Yeah. So you want uniform distribution of your HVAC air in the plenum, but if there are spots that require have higher load, you'll have more conditioned air going to those spaces to serve them, right?
In Correct. General.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it a practice, or is it just generally unacceptable that people try and use variable speed FFUs to try and accomplish some amount of temperature control for those kinds of variable loads?
It can be done.
This is a rhetorical question. I think I know the answer,
it can be done, Mark. And you know, with today's technology, you can control all the fan-powered HEPAs to a control panel located in your ante room, and you can play with that airflow. I mean, theoretically, if you're running your clean room during the day, but the clean room is not operable at night, technically, if there's no one in there and the processes are shut down, you can cycle that air back and try to save money on airflow. Because obviously you're moving a lot of air, it's costing you money.
Like set back your HEPA or your FFU speed?
Yeah. Right. But you got to be very careful with that, because if someone walks into that room, now all right. lights are off, you have to get right. back to your original. The other thing we like to do is we like to go to higher performance FFUs with ECM motors. This allows us to use probably about one third the wattage of a standard unit, and it has considerable savings. It's actually, I've actually have done jobs where I've gotten grant money from New York State because I've shown energy reduction in an FFU.
Wow. It's kind of like the LED light to the fluorescent.
Yep. Same thing.
Yep. And that counts for energy reduction. That's impressive. Is there a bit of a cost premium to go that route, or is it?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. But the few that I've done have showed, less than the 2-year payback.
Oh, well, then it makes sense. Absolutely. Assuming you want to pay for the upfront costs, which would.
Exactly. I mean, it becomes a no-brainer because you actually get that money back from the state.
Oh, so, that's really impressive. I didn't know that they would kind of fund doing that with FFUs, going with a more energy efficient. But like I said, it's the same thing as putting an LED light in, I imagine. So
if you can show the reduction in wattage, mm-hmm. They definitely are interested in it, and they are looking for those applications. So.
And it's a lot of FFUs too. If it's a pretty big clean room, like you said, there's a lot of density up there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, you know, easily I've, done rooms with 100, 150 FFUs. So if you can show a reduction in wattage by two thirds, that's huge, because you have to remember these are running 24/7. So it's probably one of the biggest contributors to your energy bill in all these plants.
Energy hogs, yeah.
Yeah, they're energy hogs. So you want to try to reduce it as much as possible.
I think that could be another podcast series too. Energy conservation and clean rooms. Wow, we got two extra podcasts coming out of this now, huh?
So, I mean, those were kind of my role, you know, as I was thinking about this. Obviously, filtration's a huge penalty, right, on the energy. But I also thought, well, maybe this is such a low priority for clean room owners because energy of what's going on in that place. So maybe something like, you know, Joe was saying behind the scenes and putting some, you know, ECM motors in or something. But I imagine if you come to them and say, I've got a better control strategy, you know, we're going to monitor your temperature or whatever. I don't know if there'd be that much of an appetite for it, but I could be wrong. But I, you know, understand the value of what goes on to the bigger organization in these clean rooms or research facility or whatever it is. But I mean, they are energy intensive, but probably on, you know, relatively small compared to what they're doing in there. No?
I would think yes.
Yeah, yeah. But there's monies out there for that. And you'd be surprised what you can get money for, you know, upgrading the HVAC filtration to something that has lower pressure drop. That could be an energy savings. There are different avenues there to save money and to get that reimbursement from the state.
Well, and that's got to be a huge avenue to look at. Like I said, the pressure drop there, but what even about, you know, occupancy control? They don't want to do anything like that. Like you said, they keep these things 24/7, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So again, it has to do with people. Mm-hmm. People are in there, you better be at full design. People aren't in there, well, maybe you could afford to cut back a little bit. So it's as simple as that.
Sure. No, I mean, they're similar, but not exactly very different profiles to like data centers, right? And I know there's
difference
in there is, okay, how do we better improve airflow distribution, things like that. So we're touching everything. And Clayton was kind of talking about that, but different types of energy intensity and those two types of special spaces.
Yeah, I didn't even cover like airflow. That's a good point, Nick. You triggered a thought. You know, dead spots in clean rooms for airflow, if there's a lot of equipment in there or stuff that gets added. You know, you have your original design, right, and your airflow layout, and then obviously spaces may change and they add equipment or what have you.
I would also think some of that has to be known ahead of time, because you don't want somebody going in there. I mean, it's not like a regular occupied space and somebody might come in and put a bookshelf or this big conference table, you know.
Right.
It doesn't really impact the design.
Right. You again, working with the owner, working with the architect, you develop where these pieces of machines are in your room. Now, if you're in a class 100,000 or class 10,000, well, airflow, we'll say, is not as critical. But if you get into a class 100, class 10 clean room, airflow patterns become critical. And at that point, you need to make a determination of where parts and pieces are inside that room. Also, you might want to invest in there's actually, you know, CAD modeling that you could actually model the airflow pattern, and you could put your HEPAs and returns in certain locations to best utilize laminar flow in the space.
Very interesting. So we're probably getting close to our time limit just for...
Oh, I want to know so much more.
I know. Do we want to touch molecular clean rooms? Because I don't know anything about those. If you want to give a brief outline, or do we want to save that for another discussion? What do you guys think?
I would think we should probably make that a next episode.
Okay.
Molecular clean rooms really take this to another level. And I think Joe's points about energy rebates and opportunities is, you know, worth further discussion as well.
Oh, yeah. I think there's so much more to talk about. So before we wrap things up and I say our thank yous and everything, for the listeners, Joe and Mike, what's the biggest takeaways from this discussion, do you think, that, you know, if somebody tuned into this podcast and they didn't know anything about clean rooms, or maybe if they were did a lot of design with clean rooms, what do you want our listeners to take away from this discussion?
Mike, you want to go first?
Filtration, airflow is critical. You know, there's a lot that goes into these spaces. Mm-hmm. Details on design, materials, where you're placing equipment, airflow. And, you know, it takes a lot of, you know, experience and the right partners to work with to, you know, have successful projects. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add, Joe.
I'm going to add on to Joe's point earlier about where did this exhaust fan come from. I think having the right partners is great, but it's also essential to be very open and communicative during the design process, understanding there's always things that happen during construction or changes that get made. But the more information that all parties have, the faster and better the design and construction can happen.
You're absolutely right, Mark. That's the key to making a clean room work, is to know up front, before you put the shovel in the ground, that you know what's going in that room, what the parameters are, and what the customer's expectation for the room is the end result. That is probably the very, very important. Because as we discussed, there's several ways to skin a cat, okay? And there's several ways to build a clean room. What you want to get is the most cost-effective way to provide a clean room with the best end result for our customer. Because at the end of the day, if the customer's not happy, I'm not happy. So we want to make sure that that need is fulfilled.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, there's a lot of common design principles when you talk about, you know, the common plenum and probably the HVAC systems and HEPA filtration and fan filter units, airflow, but it's not a kind of a copy-paste design. It's very specific to the process and what they're doing inside that clean room as well. So, right, a lot of carryovers for the principles, but not the actual implementation. That's specific to each clean room.
Exactly correct.
Yeah. I think this was a great episode, guys. I really enjoyed it. Hopefully our listeners did too. I think it's a lot to digest for in one podcast, but I think this is a good starting point to many more specific discussions. So with that being said, Joe and Mike, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast. I think it was a really great discussion. Looking forward to more to come, talking about clean rooms and expanding on the topics we covered today. Mark and Nick, thank you for joining as always. And thank you very much for our listeners for tuning in. I hope you really enjoyed the episode, and we're looking forward to having you back for another one. Have a great day, everybody.